Blog Talk Radio.
Everybody's got the fever. This is something we all know. Fever isn't such a new thing. Fever started long ago.
Good evening and welcome to Lenny Gottfried's Straight No Chaser. I have such a wonderful guest tonight, and you will be entertained by all of the things that he can inform us about his life, his career in theater, in education. But before I get to my guests, I'm not saying anything yet. I want to do a bit of my housekeeping. Those of you who have already started to call in, thank you very much. The board is filling up. I'd like to welcome to Lenny Gottfried Straight No Chaser. You are on blogtalkradio.com/ S as in Sam, F as in Fred, T as in Tom, H as in Harry, the number 2. You also are able to dial in at 516-453-6063. And if you'd like to ask a question, or if you want to say hello and have a statement, please press the number 1. We are so, I think, honored here as audience members as we listen to the stories that Sanford Sandy Robbins has to tell us. I have to tell you that I've met Sandy earlier in my life, then there was a space, and then I met him later in my life, and then there's a space, and now I have him again. And I'm not letting him go. Let me tell you about Sanford Sandy Robbins. First, he is the founder and the producing artistic director of the Resident Ensemble Players. REP is a professional theater located on the campus of the University of Delaware, as well as he's the founder and director of that university's graduate conservatory, the professional theater training program, which was ranked at one time one of the 10 top theater training programs in America. Sandy has directed. He's an educator, as you can tell, but he's directed, so many wonderful places, but among them, Oregon Shakespeare Festival, Indiana Repertory Theater, Illinois Shakespeare Festival, Los Angeles Shakespeare Festival. You tired yet? Mm-hmm. And American Players Theater. That's just among them. I'm not going to go too much further, but I want you to know that he received his BFA and an MFA from Carnegie Mellon University. Now, we can't go wrong. Now, I know that you all are saying, well, Lenny Gottfried, how did you know such an illustrious person? Sandy's going to have to tell you. I just lucked up. That's what it is. Hello, Sandy, and say hello to you.
Hello, and I think I got the better part of the luck there, but I appreciate it nonetheless.
Sandy, it is. I've been so excited to have you come on. I think I really want to let people know that Sandy gave me such a wonderful opportunity a couple of years ago to be able to bring to the campus of the University of Delaware Celeste Bedford Walker's Greenwood, An American Dream Destroyed. In a reading form. And we were talking about it. In fact, he asked me about the production off the air. It to me was a wonderful opportunity, a visionary, I think, step in as far as Sandy is concerned, of letting us tell the story of the Greenwood community in Tulsa, Oklahoma, and the disaster of 1929. And I thank you forever, Sandy, for doing that and for presenting it, and your staff and everyone was absolutely phenomenal in thinking about that. And we hope that one day, you know, we get it up again. And I hope that you're still going to be a part of that, you know.
Well, I'd love to be. I admire that piece very, very much, and what you did with it, with that really remarkable cast. And it's a story that just needs to be told, I think. And hopefully we're coming to a time when there'll be a listening for it and an opening for it, because it's an important part of our history that, as you know, is completely overlooked and kind of shunted aside when it really needs to be confronted directly, in my view.
Yes, thank you. You know, I agree with you. I think the way the Celestis has presented these characters, they do not sit in the caricature category. They are full-blown, you know, really well-developed, three-dimensional, respectable characters. No buffoonery is allowed, as they say. Leave buffoonery at the door. There's none of that, you know. And we really hope that people who have any kind of connection to that event, if they're a legacy, if their great-grandparents were connected to it, or anyone in their family, that when we get an opportunity to do it again, that they see it and we make them proud. That's the important thing.
Yes.
But you're
talking
about my production. I'm going to talk about your production. Ladies and gentlemen, I'm going to talk about it. I know Sandy, he's very humble about this, but I had an opportunity to go and see a production prior to the production that it was existing on Broadway. Production appeared at the University of Delaware, and it's called To Kill a Mockingbird. And I am here to say to you that, with all respect to Aaron Sorkin, I give you a kudos as to your interpretation. I was floored by what you did and the wonderful cast. The acting was just amazing. The set was eye-boggling. The music you all created, I sat there with my mouth open, knowing the story, knowing how much I love Gregory Peck, of course. And it just wiped it all away. And I congratulate you. It was absolutely fabulous. Congratulations.
Yeah, thank you very much. That was a pleasure to work on that piece. You know, it's every once in a while you get the chance to work on something that is so worthy of your time and energy, and something that resonates with you personally. And that was certainly one of those for me.
And to this day, I thank my associate director, Franz Jones, for being in it, so that I had an opportunity to see it.
He was
lovely in it, and
terrific.
I'm so glad. Yeah. So glad that it afforded me that opportunity to support him and in your company of brilliant actors, and the university, you know, to come and see those things. We really, really must, I think, in this country, venture out a little bit more to our very experienced universities and ensemble programs that present productions, because we really are gifted with some of performances by some of professionals like you had in your ensemble that, I mean, they've worked all over the world, decided that this is what they want to do, and you get performances that you couldn't even start to get on Broadway from these people, and I congratulate you for that. It was wonderful.
Well, thank you very much. Yeah, thank you. That's
you
make an interesting point there that it when I came into the theater, it was not unusual to have a resident company and an ensemble, as you know, Lenny. And today it's there's not much of it left. That's not the fashion at the moment. But I remember when I graduated from drama school, nobody young is going to believe what I'm about to say, but every single member of our graduating class at Carnegie in that year, everyone was offered a season's contract at one of the regional theaters in America. You know, the best actors were offered the contract at the Guthrie, and the weaker ones at some lesser places. But everybody had a year's work acting in a company, which is, I don't know any better way to become a good actor than to act.
Exactly.
And that opportunity is so missing right now. It's so tough for younger people now to find an opportunity to do work they're proud of, and particularly do work where they're on stage next to people they admire and next to people that they can learn from. We didn't realize how lucky we were.
I agree with you. I remember being in class. You know, I studied with Lloyd Richards, and Lloyd saying,
yes,
he said, if you believe that New York is the only place that there is theater, you will not work. You will not learn. Mm. If you understand that theater exists all over the world and take up the mantle and utilize that, you will have a wealth of experience and you will learn. It's a learning curve.
Yes.
You know, some people are, some people have decided they have their destination people. I want to be in LA and that's all, that's it. I want to be in Atlanta, that's it. I want to be in Chicago, that's it. I want to be in New York, that's it. If you decide, you say, you know, there are places where I can learn something. I don't say that you have to be there all the time, but know what the places that are really offering you these wonderful opportunities and to work with people who are working on a craft, not a commercial.
Yes.
You know, investment, but the craft, then it's absolutely phenomenal. It's an absolutely, I have had just a wonderful, wonderful career of going back and forth, making money, and then you don't make money, you know, but you learn so much, you know. I mean, it's just, it's wonderful. And it's meeting people like you who made, I can tell you, I was made to feel like I had just won a Tony or something when I came to your campus. I mean, they were just fabulous to us.
Yeah.
And
having you there was a very big deal for us. So we were thrilled, just thrilled. You know, I don't know if I ever told you this, but, you know, when you did the UV piece in New York, I think you were Drama Desk nominated or something for that, weren't you? Or you won.
Yes.
Anyhow, I remember quite vividly your performance in that, because you just lit up the whole stage. And you know, when Franz contacted me and said, you know, Linny would be willing to come and do a reading of this play, I was pretty excited, because you had so stunned me. So it works both ways, that's all.
Thank you. It's mutual agreement here. It's a mutual a situation where both of us mutually admire the other. And that's what happens, though, in theater. You want to work with people where that is in existence. I am in a time in my life now where I want to work with the best people that I would like to work with. You know, one of the questions that I ask when people call up, I said, well, who else is doing it? and why are they doing it? You know what I mean?
Yes. And I really appreciate it. There was a time earlier in my career when that didn't matter to me. I was happy to get the gig. But more and more, it is absolutely imperative who's doing this and what is it for and all those things that, you know, that when you're younger and trying to make it aren't, they're not at the foreground for you.
No. They're not as important. You just want to sit there. You want to sit in there. Well, now, though, you know, time is of the essence. I am older. And also, I want to give back, and I want to be in an mm-hmm. environment where that can happen also, you know. The opportunities come. They don't come as often because, you know, the kinds of roles that I'm offered now are not the same kinds of roles that I was offered when I was younger. But if they have the challenge, I'm willing. I'm willing. Of course, the pandemic has thrown a wrench in so many things.
Well, it has for sure. Yeah, it definitely has. I just got today the figures from a newsletter I get on the Broadway grosses, and boy, mm-hmm. they're not encouraging, I'll tell you.
No, it's just one of those things where you're plowing through so that you don't want to close down, but you know that you're just surviving. Your head is above water. You're just surviving.
Yeah.
And it's hard to be creative in those instances. You know, creativity needs flexibility and elasticity, and you don't have it when you're about, you know, everything about you is about to crumble. So we just keep on hoping that everyone stays strong and we push forward and find out how we can in some form survive this and still be a creative force in the arts.
Yeah, no, that's right. That's right. Yeah. And I also think that you and I both agree that the kind of work that the arts is a necessity. It's not just a extra.
Yeah.
It's not something. It's not a frill. And I believe that with every fiber of my being, and that has me encouraged to know that it may take a little longer. I understand why people are reticent to get in a crowd. I am myself a little gun shy about going some places, but I'm absolutely certain that the live theater is going to come back. And I think it could very easily come back stronger than ever because as we spend more and more of our time in smartphones and iPads and all the rest, the opportunity to sit in a room with a community of people experiencing the same thing together, breathing the same air together, I can't help but believe that that is going to be more prized than ever in this era of digital everything.
Yes. I agree with you. I think the experience of the intimacy of it, you know, that same intimacy is something that can be dangerous for a lot of us. We just have to clear that up and figure out how to function within it because it's that feeling of intimacy, that feeling of being in the moment, you know, knowing that I am so privileged to experience at this moment, this performance, because it's special. And knowing that, you never feel that anyplace else, you know.
No,
you never.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. Now, see, you guys, I've got us off on this tangent of talking about theater, but I'm going to get back on you, Sandy.
Okay. All right.
When? Because I don't know. Where are you originally from?
I was born in Seattle, Washington, and my family moved to Los Angeles when I was about 6 and a half years old. So I was brought up in L.A., but I'm a Seattle boy.
Oh, a Seattle. One of my friends, Mark, is a Seattle person and an avid listener. I'm hoping he's listening today. I think he is. You know, when I was in Los Angeles, I did a production of No Place to Be Somebody.
I'm very fond of that play. The author of that play, Charles Gordon, it says Gordone, but it was Gordon. Chuck was a friend and somebody I really grew up admiring as an actor, actually, before he wrote that play.
Before he wrote the play, yes.
Yeah.
He came to the theater and he and Bill Duke together directed that piece. I had the honor of working with Charles, and it was
fabulous.
It was an incredible experience because the play had already been done, and there were people who had gone on and become luminaries because of their performances in it. So you know, you wanted to do it justice. You didn't want to make any missteps. And here is the man. Thank you.
Right.
That wrote it, that he is now, you know, in the theater working with us. And I remember, and I'm going to say this quickly because I do want to go back to you, but another theatrical experience that you get that you can't get anywhere else. I'm doing one point, and Cara Mae Weasley had this one line. I always reversed it. I don't know why. My sense of the rhythm of the piece, I always reverse. I put one sentence in for the other, and he wrote it the other way around. And I'm like, I'd get into rehearsal, and I talked to myself. I said, now he's out there say it right. And I'd get into the character, and no matter what, that character would take me straight that way. So one day he just pulled me over. He said, so you like saying those two lines in reverse, don't you? I said, I'm so sorry. I really can't. He said, no, you know, I think I like that. I think I'm going to go back to Samuel French and tell them to reverse it.
Oh, that's pretty good, Lenny. That's really great.
I believe he did, but I was like, I sat there going, oh, okay. Where, I mean, in live theater, where could you have the Bill Dukes, the Charles Scott? Where could you get all of that in one place?
Yeah.
It was at the Matrix Theater amazing. In Los Angeles, at the Matrix Theater.
I remember that theater. Yeah. That's a great story. I love it.
Yeah.
Go
mm-hmm.
ahead. I was just going to say my first experience of your playwright and director, Charles Gordon, was mm-hmm. oddly enough when he was playing the role of Richard III in Shakespeare's Richard III in Los Angeles. And he was stunning, and I mean, really mean stunning. And it was a production I was hoping would go to New York or something would come of it. And he did it in New York and it closed and he went on to whatever was next. But I won't ever forget it. It was really one of those performances over which you don't get.
Yes. It's amazing. You know, you get one or two. There are a lot of gigs that you do, as we talked about earlier in the theater. There are a lot of gigs. And then there are pieces that mold you, you know, if they don't mold you, they mold your audience. That the audience never forgets that you've done, and you've been very blessed to do that. And I do understand what you're saying with him remembering him. He was a gentle, sweet man, very, very, very sweet man. You know, never, you know, very understanding about his work. Everyone was respectful of his work, but he wasn't. He wasn't arrogant about it, and of course it had won a Pulitzer. So I mean, you know, but he made you comfortable, and he made it safe for you to be creative, for you to breathe into his work, and that is a rarity. Now, tell me, you were in Los Angeles, so when did you decide? Los Angeles is such a television medium, a film medium.
Yeah.
How did you get into
theater? I decided that at about 13, but it didn't do me any good till I was old enough to go to college.
Okay.
I can't tell you why. My father was a retail jeweler, and my mom was a housewife, and I don't have any relatives who are in our industry at all, but I knew from my earliest recollection that I wanted to be in the theater. And Los Angeles, as you are pointing out, is no place for the theater particularly. I made sure I got to see everything that came to town that was worth seeing, and there was a good deal that toured to Los Angeles, fortunately,
mm-hmm.
and seeing those productions, particularly the early productions of the Guthrie Theater and American Conservatory Theater and the APA and even Galleons formed my aesthetic. And then I went to Carnegie Mellon University because I'd read in all the who's who's in the playbills that so many of the people I admired had gone there. So it just seemed like a good idea. And I didn't know much what I was doing. And so I applied and got in, LA was not wasn't the sort of place I would have loved to have grown up in a more theater centered environment,
mm-hmm.
but it worked out.
It did. When you applied to Carnegie Mellon, did you apply with any discipline in mind?
I applied and accepted as an actor, and mm-hmm. shortly after in the first year, I think, I made a discovery, which was that if you're in the acting program, they could put you in any play they wanted, but if you were a director, you could still act, but you got to pick what you were in, and you got to direct. So I switched to being a directing major, because that way I didn't have to be in the stuff I didn't want to be in, and I could still be in the ones that they wanted me for that turned out to be fun. Now, that wasn't always such a smart move, because I was cast in the original cast of Godspell, and which originated there. And I got myself out of it, because I thought, who the hell wants to be in a musical about Jesus, for God's sake? I'd rather be in Shakespeare. And all my friends who were in Godspell are, they all have mansions on Malibu Beach. So that decision didn't turn out altogether so brilliantly.
Sandy, that's funny. But also it's the turns in the road. I mean, I was just going to ask you, was there any other thing that you considered? And so you considered acting, but you changed to directing. But before that, there was nothing else in your mind. What did your family think about your decision?
My family, like most families, you know, the last thing they want to hear from their eldest son is, I want to go into the theater. I think I terrified my parents. They were supportive, and they were wonderful, Lenny, but they were fearful. When you confront the
statistics.
Which,
as we are today, yes.
Yeah, sure. I mean, God, you know, you look at the statistics of the employment in our profession, and nobody in their right mind for whom it wasn't a calling would select it.
Exactly.
I was just saying, I've been blessed because I've had a job pretty consistently. There have been periods where not, but not long periods. And I've gotten to get paid for what I wanted to do. I don't know any other gift you could have in life than to be compensated for the thing you'd do for free.
It's amazing, you know, and I think that's the thing that we talk about that describes a calling and a passion. And that is, you know, when people say to me about how does it feel to be on Broadway, and I go, the same way it feels every time I hit any stage. You know, Broadway is a location. It's a fabulous location, and it's a great credit. But the same performances that you get paid all of that money, I did for free in a showcase.
And I did
them well enough so that it qualified to get me there. So what you say is so very, very right, is that we would do it for free. I'm not going to say that a whole lot, because don't get carried away, anyone. I'm not working for free.
I understand. I understand. No, it's not a good. You don't want your employers to know that necessarily,
but it is the
truth.
Yes, you know, but it is when it is that calling, when it is the passion that you have in it. You immediately, there are certain things that go up, antennas go up when it's that kind of role that you want to go, oh my gosh, I must do this. I really must do this, you know. So you didn't, the family reacted like my family reacted, you know, when it was like, okay, I don't think that I'm going to stay in the corporate world. I'm not going to keep working for Exxon. I'm going to, because that's where I was training during college. You know, I got an opportunity, and I was like, you know, that was fabulous. No, I'm going to go into the theater. My father almost had a heart attack, but, you know, but eventually we proved to them that we can make a living. We're pretty good at all of that. But so tell me, do you feel about, in the years you talk about, you've worked a great deal. In all the things you have done in your work, how successful were you, I think, in reaching the vision that you had for yourself? And maybe I should ask, what vision did you have for yourself?
Well, I think early on, my vision was to be employed, and I mean, I didn't have the loftiest of goals, because it seemed to me that what I was aspiring to was so unlikely and so far removed from reality. So I think I kept my ambitions suppressed a little bit very early on. But mm-hmm. but not too long after, I had the gift of really great mentors. And I don't know where I would be or what I would be had that not been the case. But I, in my teenage years, there was a woman who you will know, and perhaps some of your listeners might know of, named Eva LaGallion. Was one of the great, one of the great people in the history of the American theater. And in her later years, she taught, and she taught in her home in Connecticut, and as a boy, my grandfather, who was knew nothing of the arts really, except that they were good for you, and he took me to the Biltmore Theater in Los Angeles at 9 years old to see a production of The Master Builder of all things by Ibsen. Now, a kid my age could not even who goes to see The Master Builder at any age, let alone. But he thought it would be good for me, and he was a sweet man and wanted me to grow up exposed to such things. So anyhow, I went to this theater. The curtain went up, and it was the first play I saw, a live play. And from the moment the curtain went up, it was over for me. I mean, there was no other aspiration to have except to be part of whatever that was. I must have sat there with my mouth open. And anyhow, she came back to Los Angeles, I don't know, when I was in junior high school. And I was one of those kids, I was a kind of good kid. I was more, afraid to break rules, and I was by no means a rebel. But when she came back to town, about 8 years later, 9 years later, I snuck out of school every matinee day and took the bus down to downtown Los Angeles so I could go see her. And I would sneak in, and then I would go to the men's room after the matinee so that I could stand on the toilet and hide and then sneak out to see the evening performance. and I did this, I never got caught. And so I saw more performances of Ibsen than any kid in America, I'm quite sure. But the point of the story is that she, I finally worked up the courage to knock on her dressing room door, and I didn't know what to say or anything. I just wanted to meet this person. And I'm sure you have an experience like this. The dressing room door opened, and this little tiny woman who on the stage seemed to be gigantic,
yes,
but there backstage in the dressing room was, was 5 feet tall,
mm-hmm.
answered. And she talked to me for 2 or 3 hours, at the end of which she said, well, you're very young, but if your parents would let you, I invite you to come to Connecticut this summer when I'm conducting these classes and to be there. And I, I thought I'd won 10 lotteries. And I went home, and I don't know how I persuaded my parents to let me go to Connecticut to not only let me, but to pay for it. And I did. And I got to sit at the feet at 14 years old of one of the great figures in the history of the American theater. And that was the beginning of a series of mentors like of that caliber that I have been blessed to have. And so my ambitions, to get back to your question, were forged by the people I admired wanting to do work like the kind of work that had inspired me as a kid.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been in pursuit of it since. I think there's certain things that you see early in your life that touch you deeply in ways you can't even explain. And for me, at least, the rest of my professional life has been reaching toward that.
Well, that, you know, how wonderful, what a wonderful opportunity. Now, when you say you went that summer, did you go back again?
I went back one more year, also in the summer. And after that, she was too old to do that sort of thing again. But
yes,
we stayed
yes.
in touch. We stayed in touch. And then years later, when I was in college, I got the opportunity to assistant direct on Broadway to a man named Ellis Rabb, who was directing The Royal Family. And she mm-hmm. was in it as a quite elderly woman. But there's a role of a kind of matriarch grandmother in that play, and she played it. So my job, I got to be an apprentice, or I don't know what I was called. I was an assistant, and which really meant going for coffee mostly.
Mm-hmm.
And I got to take care of her. I got to take care of her Pekingese, Lenny. That was my job in the theater was to feed Eva LaGallien's Pekingese dog, which I did diligently.
Did she remember you, Sandy?
Yeah, she did. She did. And we'd corresponded from time to time. And she, you know, all she would do was talk to me about the theater, about repertory, about what was, from her perspective, missing in the American culture that mm-hmm. that the European culture had, which was great ensemble theater companies.
Yes.
And
yes.
so that yes. was what I aspired to.
Yes.
And,
yes.
you know, I got lucky enough to be able to have my own company for the last 15 years.
Absolutely incredible. What do you think about where we are in theater? You know, we talked a little bit off air as to what appeals to us. Where do you want theater to go? I mean, this last statement that you talked about, when you talked and learned about the Europeans and their accent and their focus on ensemble work, which I believe I think strengthens them, because of course there's a chain of that happens in an ensemble. The members, I think, push the other members to be better and better and better.
That's right.
That competitiveness, but just knowing that makes you stronger. Where do you think we are in America as far as that's concerned?
Well, I think there's two things happening. I want to first say that this idea of ensemble, while at that time when she was talking to me, it was really, you had to point to Europe, but there have been great, as you know, great American companies, the American
yes.
Conservatory Theater, the Negro
yes.
Ensemble Company was one of the great, you know, one of my other mentors was Roscoe Lee Brown, and Roscoe was a member of that company.
Exactly.
Anyhow, there have been, fortunately, I got to see and even work at some of those kinds of theaters. But to answer your question, at the moment, my view of things is that one very, very good thing is happening, and that is that we are including people who have traditionally been excluded, and the theater is beginning to tell stories that have been there all along, great stories that weren't represented on our stages for the most part. And I think that's an enormously healthy thing, that we've opened up participation in the theater way wider than it was when I came into it. When I came into the theater, there was very few people of color. There were very few openly gay and lesbian people participating. There were you never saw a disabled person. You know, if there was a disabled role, you saw an actor pretend to be disabled. Today we've opened up those opportunities, and I think that's a hugely important thing, and that the benefits of it are going to be enormous, because it means that young people who in the past would never think of themselves as people who were going to go into our profession will see role models, will see, gee, I could do that. And I expect that the benefits of that are going to be staggering over time. So that, to me, that's just a terrifically healthy thing. At the same time, unfortunately, the economy for the theater has gone to hell, attendance right now, post-pandemic, is very weak. So as you said earlier, we've got to get through this difficult period financially for the theater, because if we can, and we will, mm-hmm. I think something extraordinary can happen again. You know, I earn my living as a director of plays, and I just stepped down as of August 31st from the theater I was running. So now I'm a freelancer for the first time in about 30 years. And and the plays you're offered are small plays right now. They're 3 and 4 and maybe 5 character plays. I spent most of my life doing plays that had 30 people in them.
Yeah.
And so that's a big change, and I don't think it's an altogether healthy change. But I'm optimistic by nature, and I think that we'll come to a place where audiences demand larger plays and we'll be able to produce them.
I'm hoping that. I want to say now, I want to interject this so that if anyone, the board is full, if anyone has a question, if you're listening and you're not on the board and you want to call in, it's 516-453-6063. Press the number 1. If you have a question, now is the time to do it, because we are down to, we'll have about another 11, 12 minutes, and then we'll start having to wind this down. I told you how quickly it goes.
It does.
It really does. So my concern, and I agree with you, that in the theater, eventually we will come to a point where the pendulum will swing back the other way, that the audiences will want something. But right now I hear playwrights talking. I work with a lot of playwrights with the ensemble that I'm at the helm of. And with EOA, usually when you talk to a playwright, they go, well, I've written a play. It only has 3 characters. They've now, decided that in order to get their play done, they have a formula for it. And that disturbs me because of the simple fact that doesn't that just stunt the creativity when you think, well, the only thing that I can do is write something that has 3 characters, or it really must have this kind of person and that kind of person in it and that kind of person in it. And what are your thoughts about that when approached as a director?
Well, I first of all, I share your view that it's very limiting on the one hand. I also know that in our profession, sometimes there are some people who embrace limitations in a way where something just mind-bogglingly great happens that probably wouldn't have happened if you'd had all the resources. Now, that oughtn't to justify not having resources, but I do think that it's a shame that people can't both write, direct, and act in large work, because it's different and you learn things that are very valuable that I don't think are available in small plays have their rewards too. There's no question about it. The intimacy and the kind of story that can be told, and the way it calls the audience almost onto the stage in a good intimate play. But there's something to be said for epics, that inspire us in ways. The New Ensemble Company did a play. I'm struggling to think of the name of it. Early in their career, that my friend Roscoe Lee Brown was in, and it had 35 people, and it was based on a Herman Melville book. God, I wish I could remember it. In any case, the point is that it was so large in scope, both the scope of the story and the scope of the presentation, that it swept you over in a way that is difficult when you're only doing smaller pieces. And it's a shame that younger people today are currently rarely able to have that experience.
Yeah. I remember being in school and there being 3-4 plays featuring people of color on Broadway, and I'm saying to myself, I know I can make a living at this. I can make a living with this. Whereas maybe a decade before, 2 decades before, there wasn't a living. It was a calling.
Yes.
It was a calling.
Yes.
When people were acting in the plays, when Day of Absence happened with NEC, you know, when all of those actors were not actors because they were going to be offered a $1 million contract to, you know, do the play and then tour and then maybe do the film. No, that did you did the play because you did the play because you had to
That's
do
right.
the play. You know?
Yeah.
And that's the feeling that you want, and you want that feeling also to be limitless. I don't want it to say, and in some cases, I don't want my black playwrights to say to me, I have to put a white character in here, otherwise, you know, white theaters won't do my play.
Yeah.
I don't want to happen. I've had them say that to me.
Yeah, well, I'm sure they have, and nobody in their right mind would want that. You want a world in which it's open to everyone, and quality demands attention, you know, and that period, and that we're not there, but with any luck and with the commitment of people who are working, it'll move more and more in that direction. I think there's some hopeful signs. I know that I tend to be an optimist by nature, but I really genuinely do think there are signs that that something is stirring that is going to explode sometime after the right vaccines and all the rest of it, that people are going to demand the scope of work that I know and you know the theater can provide.
I believe so. Now, we have someone who has a question. So I'm going to I'm going to let them in. Hold on for a moment.
I know what you know theater can provide.
Hello and welcome to Great Note Chaser.
Good evening.
Good evening.
Can you hear me?
Yes, I can. Yes, I can.
This is Franz Jones.
That sounds familiar. Great Note
Chaser. This is Franz Jones.
Yes,
Franz
I know.
Jones.
You know what?
What a treat!
you may
I wanted to say to Sandy, Benito Cereno is the play you're thinking of.
Thank you. That is exactly the play I'm thinking of. And you are always reliable to know those things. Thank you.
Say it again. Say it again.
How are you?
Wait a minute, Franz, say the title.
Benito Cereno.
That's
right. Benito Cereno.
Thank you. Thank you.
Yeah.
And we spoke.
Yes, as a matter of fact, when I was in undergraduate school, we did it. That's the reason why I can remember. Yeah. I wasn't actually in it. I worked on the crew. The leading role that Roscoe Lee Brown played of the servant, the slave that seemed to be so obsequious that turns out to be the leader of the rebellion.
Right.
The director said that the look in my eye was too fierce, that you could tell almost immediately that I was going to rebel.
You were
going
to be.
And there
was
the other character, Atufal, yes, that was thought to be the leader. But the guy that played that was a big muscle guy. They wanted him for his body, not necessarily for his ability as an actor. So I wasn't in that particular production. I was just backstage doing stuff. But, yeah, I remember that show. I remember reading about it and read the play, of course. And I had a book when I was in high school called Black Magic that had a listing of various productions done by black people. And there's a picture of him in there with Frank Langella, I believe, played the captain.
Right. Right. God, hands on my back, Franz.
Yes. Thank you, Franz. I mean, well, thank you. We spoke about you earlier because it is because of you that I got a chance to see that wonderful To Kill a Mockingbird.
Yeah,
and,
that was a great production, Sandy. And thank you again for including me. I had a great time.
Oh, I'm the lucky guy that got to have you in a play. You make me look good.
Oh, somebody's sending somebody a check here. I can do
that. Absolutely.
I didn't get my check this month. What's going on? I'm getting left out here.
Listen. We all deserve a check. We all do. And I hope that sometime soon we'll all get the chance to work together again. I've been working with Lenny right now, but I hope to get a chance to work with you again, Sandy, before they take me
that.
Out of here.
Yeah,
well, I'd love that.
Yeah, but I'm going to let you guys continue the conversation. I just wanted to come in and give you that name and who it was.
Yeah.
But
thank
enjoy
you.
The conversation.
Great
I know you don't have but so much time.
Yes. Thank you.
Brian.
Thank you so much.
Great to hear from you.
Great to talk to you, too.
Sandy, now that we were talking, about, you know, doing work, what is the next thing for you? What can we expect from Sandy Robbins now?
Well, I don't know what you expect from me, but I'm going to, God willing, and the creek don't rise, I'm going to do a play next season at the Westport Playhouse in Connecticut, and we're still discussing titles, so I can't tell you what it's going to be yet, but we're narrowing it down. And then I'm working on a production that they're still trying to get the financing for, so God only knows if it's going to happen, but it would be a production of King Lear, and it would have it would be inappropriate for me to say who would be in it, but it'll be people whose names you recognize. I'm very hopeful that will happen. That's one of the world's great plays ever, and the concept we have for it, I think, is very timely and relevant. So I'm hoping that'll go. And other than that, that's it for me for the time being. I've stepped down from running a theater day to day, and I'm looking forward to actually not doing quite at that pace.
I totally understand. Yes.
Quite all right.
Breathing is what you know.
Yeah. And I have about 10 million DVDs I should watch sometime before I die.
I understand. Now, if I were to ask you this question, what would be your answer? What is it that you would like us to know about you that we don't know?
Oh, gosh. Well, I don't know. I don't know. I have to, you know, I'd like to think that I'm not the most important person on the planet for myself, and I really try very hard to live my life in a way where it's of some value to the people around me, and I'm, you know, I fail at it probably as often as I succeed, but I'm really organized as best I can be, Lenny, around the empowerment of people around me and getting around me those people who, if they were empowered, they could make a big difference in this world. And that's what turns me on more than anything.
All right. I can understand that. Given that, you know, you have certain projects that are scheduled. Is there any project that you want to do that you've always wanted to do, or any particular project or person that you want to work with?
Well, there's a lot of people I'd love to work with. There are some plays that I would be very, very keen to do. And some of them are plays I have done and would like to revisit, and others are ones I haven't. But Lear, incidentally, is a play I've not directed. It's probably the only major Shakespearean play I've not had the chance to direct. But the play The Winter's Tale is to me very timely at the moment, because it's about forgiveness and redemption, and the just the essential necessity of mercy. And it seems so very missing in our politics at the moment. And it's a play that really, when well done, is terribly moving.
and I think affects people in a way they can't even articulate. So I'd love another crack at that one.
Hmm. When was the last time you directed it?
I directed it with our company in, oh, God, I'm terrible at years, but about 10 years ago.
About 10 years
and it
ago.
Wasn't, it, the, yeah, the moment wasn't quite as ripe for it, you know, at that time as it, I believe it to be now.
Mm-hmm.
That, yeah. You know, my sense of the world we're living in right now is that it's not just my sense, but anybody with any sense could think that it's bitterly divided and people are at sixes and sevens. They don't know even what facts to believe. You know, I didn't think
exactly.
I didn't think I'd live in an era when what is factual would be up for grabs, but I do. And so
yes.
those I think the arts are very important more than ever. They're always important, but they're very important in a particular respect right now because they give us truth that isn't of a factual nature. It's a different kind of truth. It's a truth that resonates in our souls, so to speak. And
mm-hmm.
So I'm interested in plays that that remind us that that the things we think are important aren't necessarily the things that are most important. And Shakespeare and the great classics offer that to us. So those are the plays I'd like to spend the rest of my life doing. Not just Shakespeare, but those classics that remind us that being human is bigger than anybody's personality.
Yes, understood. Understood. I think we're going to have to close with that because we're down to the last couple of minutes. And I want people to know that we're going to do a video, the after show afterthought. So they'll get a chance to continue. We'll continue a little bit of this. But for those people who won't get a chance to see it immediately, we're going to be doing it right afterwards. I want them and everyone to know how wonderful this whole hour has been. It would be great to if you would create a panel talking about theater. Because the conversation is so important that people understand all the different point of views and how important theater is to our day in and day life, you know, day in and day out life. And you could do it, Sandy.
Well, there's a gauntlet thrown down. All right.
Only because the conversation it really is an important conversation, and so many times I've listened to panels where people are talking, but when you really dig down, they haven't walked the walk, you know. They've kind of cosmetically done the walk.
I'd consider it if you'd open it up by singing Miss Otis Regrets. Then I'd consider doing anything.
Well, that's something. We're going to talk about that then. We'll talk about that in the next part.
All right,
well,
good.
I'd like to...
Good.
Okay. Oh,
all right, I'll
God.
See you on YouTube in a moment then.
Thank you very much. Well, I'd like to, first of all, thank everyone for listening to Lenny Gossi Straight No Chaser. We'll be back next week with some wonderful guests. We'll have Dave and Monica Willard, who are in the area, the Lehigh Valley area, on entrepreneurs, and she is just retired from work with the United Nations. So we'll have a lot to talk about the theater and the world next week. But until then, I say thank you for listening, and I'll see you on the radio on Lenny Gottfried's Straight No Chaser. Bye bye now. This is something we all know. Fever.
fever isn't such a new thing. Fever started long ago. Never know how much I love you. You never know how much I